day, everyone. So for anyone tuning in for the first time, this is the Catalyzer podcast. We're here bringing you insights from the world of migrant and refugee entrepreneurs in Sydney. My name is Jacob Muller. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Catalyzer. And joining me here today is Usman Iftikhar, the CEO of Catalyzer. For a quick introduction to what we do, Catalyzer is a startup incubator for refugee and migrant entrepreneurs. So we take migrants and refugees who want to start their own startup, but a fairly early stage, usually at the idea stage, and we plug them in with all of the tools they need to start their own startup and ultimately make sales and move through to their first capital raise. And so to date, we've worked with about 60 migrantpreneurs. We're just wrapping up our third program. And throughout the course of our last program, we'd been thinking about ways that we can share the insights and learnings that come out of our program with a much broader community. So part of our program, we run events, and in particular fireside chats, where we bring in successful people in various fields. And we basically have a fairly candid conversation with them about, what are the key mental models and thought processes that they apply to their work and that make them successful. You know, what's the early stage advice that they would give to founders? Generally just nuggets of wisdom that will help people aspiring to start their own startup to succeed. And so this podcast is a conversation that we recorded from a prior fireside chat. For us, this is a bit of an experiment to see whether people in our broader network and community are interested in this and whether they get any value of it. And I guess our intention is, if so, then we may continue recording them. Over to you, Oz.
Thanks, Jake. Our first podcast is based on a chat with Peter Huynh, who is a migrantpreneur himself. So he moved to Australia as a refugee with his family from Vietnam and has shown incredible leadership in various different arenas. He's very well known and involved in the startup ecosystem as an investor and mentor. He's also currently a co-founder and investor at Qualgrow, a Series A and onwards VC fund that invests in B2B startups across Australia, New Zealand, and Southeast Asia. We have a very wide-ranging conversation from Peter's refugee journey to early life in Australia to some of his nuggets of gold for founders who want to make a mark. And we also talk about some mindfulness and meditation. You will have a treat listening to this, so definitely check it out and enjoy. Thanks.
So I want to start with your personal story. Do you want to tell us a bit more about your experience as a founder, as an investor, some key nuggets of gold that you've collected over time?
My story? I was born in Vietnam. My parents and I made it to Australia after the Vietnamese War ended. We arrived, in fact, in December 1977. So in a couple of weeks' time, it'll be 40 years since we arrived in Australia. My dad was a young doctor during the war. And then when we came to Australia, he did his med degree again at Sydney Uni, so he did his med degree twice. In Vietnam at the time, at university, they taught medicine, all of university was taught in French, so I had to learn English when he arrived, and then pass the exam to, make it into medicine, did his med degree again. And during that time, we were very poor. We couldn't afford actually to live in Sydney. So we lived with some of my mum's brothers, my uncles, who were working at the steelworks in Wollongong, in Port Kembla. And we lived there for 4 years. My mum would sew. My dad was a student, so he had actually no income at all. It actually was quite formative. That period was quite formative for me. We lived 10 people in a two-bedroom apartment in Fairy Meadow in Wollongong. And then, of course, once Dad graduated, which was 1984, I think it was, 83, 84. You know, everything changed because we could afford to, you know, move to Sydney, live together as a family. So I actually didn't see my dad very much when I was young because he was, you know, always studying in Sydney and we were living in Wollongong. So he would travel back, I think, once every fortnight, once every 2 weeks for the weekend. When we first moved to Sydney, we lived in Auburn for a while. And then we lived in Cabramatta for a few years. And then we moved back to Auburn. I went to high school near Liverpool in a school called Hurlston Agricultural High School. It's an ag school, so it's a farming school. and it's a fantastic school, but I think it's closing down or moving, or they're selling off the land for apartments. And so I would do sort of all these ag subjects like, you know, land economics and crop rotation and, you know, and working with cows and pigs and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And after high school, I went to university. I studied, I did a BA LLB, which is law and arts. And after I finished, I figured that I actually didn't like working within the law. I love studying law, but I didn't really like, you know, working within the law. So I joined Computer Sciences Corporation in their graduate program. And I started off as a BA, as a business analyst. And, you know, I was rolling out enterprise packages for large corporates like AMP. I don't know, we'd roll out, you know, implementations of Lotus Notes. And then at the time, you know, sort of early e-commerce packages, procurement packages. And then I joined an advertising group called WPP Group.
Yep.
And they had a digital agency, a global digital agency group called XM. And I helped them set up and run their operations in Sydney, Melbourne, KL. So I lived in KL for 2 years during that time. When I came back from KL, I joined Hutchison Group. This was, you know, 2005. Hutchison Group is a large conglomerate that does like ports, shipping, utilities, and it used to own a telco in Australia called Three Mobile. And Three Mobile was where I worked for Hutchison. I worked for them in Sydney, then in London. So in London, I worked on like, you know, global business development with internet companies, like negotiating things like the revenue share for Google Play. At the time, it was called Android Market. Working with Facebook for the rollout of Facebook Zero. And that's where I really got exposed to, you know, startup world and startup life. So, for example, I worked with Facebook mobile team on the rollout of Facebook Zero. And they would be using all this sort of terminology that I would not understand. let's just get this out, you know, just like, wait, we'll just MVP it. I'm like, what's an MVP? This is in 2009, so there was no Lean Startup book. Right, it was just like some blog posts, or you know, like it didn't exist. And so I was like, "This is really cool. I love the way that this is being done because we're doing things so quickly and you know, lightweight. And this is awesome. I want to get more into this." And that time when I was in London as well, you know, from time to time, the folks who were making investments within the group would sort of send stuff to us, like, you know, "Hey, can you do some diligence on this? What do you think about this?" And so I was like, "Oh, what is this whole venture capital stuff? This is really cool." So when I came back to Sydney in 2011 and joined Singtel Group instead, because by that time, you know, Hutchison had merged with Vodafone, which hadn't happened when I had left, I was like, oh, I really want to sort of help Optus set up something within the startup space. And so I worked within the corporate VC of Singtel Group, known as Singtel Innovate. It's a $250 million fund that invests in startups all around the world. And I helped to set them up in Australia. And in Australia, it's called Optus Innovate, because you know, people don't know who Singtel Group is. And I also led tech M&A for them, acquiring businesses, you know, all around the world, here in Australia, New York, Israel, all around the world. So I was with them for 4 years. And then I left in April of 2015 to set up my own fund with two other friends. And we raised, it was quite unusual. Normally for your first fund, it takes about a year to raise that fund, right? We were very fortunate. We raised within 3 months, in fact, less than 3 months. And so we launched the fund, we fully raised and closed the fund on the 8th of August, 2015. Okay, and it's a US $50 million fund investing in tech startups in the B2B space, specifically in SaaS data. We've been, you know, investing since then. We've made now 16 investments. So we've been around just over 2 years. We've made 16 investments, 4 investments in Australia, the rest all across Asia. So Singapore, Taiwan, India, Myanmar, Indonesia. And the 4 investments in Australia are Data Republic, which is a data exchange platform, Open Agent, which is a service that recommends the best real estate agent to sell your property, Neura, which is actually a pair of headphones that when you put the headphones on for the first time, it measures your hearing profile by bouncing sound waves off your inner ear. In fact, off the hair in your inner ear. And it measures your hearing profile. And from that point onwards, all sound that goes through those headphones is optimized towards your specific hearing. And we invested in that as a data play, right? We don't really invest in sort of consumer electronics. And our 4th investment is actually going to be announced on the week of the 20th of November, so coming up very soon. And that's in an enterprise SaaS business here in Sydney. It's been a pretty intensive process. We've made 16 investments now. We'll probably make another 4 investments out of the first fund. And we're in the process of closing our second fund at the moment. So the second fund is 100 million US. And we'll close that in February of next year. And so, you know, the way that it's timed is that we'll finish making investments out of the first fund and then we'll start making investments out of the second fund. So that's the journey to to this point. It's been it's a pretty incredible journey. I feel very, very lucky, to be able to have worked, all around the world, all across Asia, Europe, and the States as well. I feel very, very lucky. And so I always love the chance to be able to share anything that I've learned with folks who are interested. I guess the other thing is that I continue to have my learner hat on because, there's so much to learn. It's constantly changing the way that venture capital works, the way that technology works. It's all constantly evolving. I think the biggest thing for us is we always, as a firm, our firm, challenge ourselves on how well can we learn about new spaces and form a view in relation to these new spaces that are emerging.
Right. So I'm going to kick off with a couple of questions.
Yeah.
So first is like, and you can answer them in whatever order you want.
Yeah.
So first is like, what did you want to become when you were a kid?
Huh.
And why? And who's been your role model that has sort of impacted your life?
My dad is probably my biggest role model growing up. Within the Vietnamese community, if your dad's a doctor, they kind of expect you to be a doctor as well. But I was never really good at any of that sort of stuff. And so I kind of knew that I wasn't going to be a doctor. And I guess early on, I thought I was going to be a lawyer, which is what I worked towards. But when I realized, the nature of the work, it wasn't dynamic enough for me. It wasn't, I love the fact that for what I do, things are constantly changing. I'm constantly having to learn. I mean, on a weekly basis, right? If not daily. It's very different in terms of, I used to love studying constitutional law, Australian constitutional law. And I used to love it because it's Australian. And, it's like, I love this. And Australian constitutional law is quite progressive, right? In sort of a global context. But it's still, you know, to be an expert in Australian constitutional law, you know, you're doing the same thing and looking at the same stuff for 10 years to be an expert on that. And I wasn't really down for that. Yeah, I thought I was going to be a lawyer. I ended up, you know, and I ended up sort of thinking, not rather than what did I think I wanted to be, I ended up making this shift in perspective to think, what are the principles behind what I really want to do? And then the sort of job and work fell in behind that, you know, rather than I want to be a lawyer, it was, I want to work in a space that is dynamic and fast moving, where I can help people, you know, where I'm working directly with folks who are, you know, doing their best work and doing their life's work and that sort of stuff, right? And that led me to working in venture capital. Mm. Yeah.
Can I jump in?
Yeah.
What are some of the habits and tools that you've picked up or developed along the way that help you continue learning on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, so I set aside some time in the morning, every single morning, to go through key reading. Right, and so what my process is, I'll go through and read, you know, all the topics that are important to me, all the news sources that are important to me, and I'll pick out some of the important stuff. And then we have, you know, we use Slack internally, so you know, I'm basically just messaging to the team and putting it into different channels. You know, here's what's happening in crypto, here's what's happening in AI ML, here's what's happening in whatever it might be. Right, oh, here's a great new post on like SaaS valuation. And so that's a habit. That's something that happens every single, you know, morning. And yeah, it's pretty much, it's not the very first thing I do, but it's one of the first things that I do. Because as I said, the game is constantly changing. And so we've got to make sure that we're not only up to date, but really understand how things are sort of evolving day to day, but also sort of from a more macro level as well.
Do you have any suggestions on how to stop other people encroaching on your sacred learning time in the morning?
Yeah, do it early.
Yeah.
Right? Do it early. Like, you know, start as early as you can in the morning, like 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever it is. And people are less likely to encroach upon your time. The reality is it's usually me that's encroaching upon my own time. Right, which is like, oh, look, I could do that, but there's this email and I really want to respond to it right now. Right? And it's just sort of, hey, no, I'm going to park that. You know, that's a separate time. Right now, I'm going to go through it. I'm going to do, you know, these readings. Yeah, that's a, you know, but the earlier in the morning that you can do it, the less likely you're going to be disturbed.
What's the best advice you can give for the first time founders? Especially guys here and also listening to this.
Yeah, first time founders, the best advice I can give is treat it all as a learning exercise, right? Everything is a learning exercise. So rather than holding on to the outcome, being really attached to the outcome, use any outcomes as a like litmus test or barometer for where you're at, right? As in, okay, I'm doing this, but the outcome's not exactly what I want. This is the outcome. Maybe I need to re-engineer how I'm doing stuff, right? Rather than being so attached to the outcome that you're not watching the learnings. Because everything that you're doing as a first-time founder is all about learning. And oftentimes, the learning is a learning about yourself, right? The learning about customers and what they want is relatively obvious, right? You can see in their behavior, you can see in the action, you can see in the data. The non-obvious learning is the learning about yourself, which is, you know, this thing happens, I instinctively do this, and this is typically the outcome. And so what you're trying to understand about yourself is, how am I seeing this situation in this particular way, such that I always do this, and I always have this pattern, right? And it might be around stress, it might be around working with teammates, it might be whatever it might be. And so what you're really learning is, how am I looking at the world right now? Does something have to change about that? And what do I need to change to make myself even more successful on the other end? If I want to change the outcome, then I need to change the pattern. If I want to change the pattern, I need to change how I'm looking at the world and myself. What is that? Right? So everything is a learning. And the learning is as much internal as it is external.
What are some of the most common pitfalls that first-time founders fall into in terms of the patterns they find themselves in?
Yeah, I mean, there are some common pitfalls. The first one, of course, is, and you folks will be past this point by now, but, you know, the first one is, I'm not going to tell anybody because someone's going to steal my idea, right? I'm sure you folks are past that now, right? Which is, hey, I want to tell everybody because I need this feedback. I need to know that, you know, what I'm building is something that folks are interested in and want. I guess the other one that I see really often is holding on really tightly to this view around equity, right? Optimizing for equity. And I constantly have to tell founders, you know, look, it's great that you have a view on it. It's great that you sort of are mindful of it. But what you should be optimizing are for people who are looking to invest in your company that you can work with for the next 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And that, you know, you feel that they understand you and what you're doing or what you're trying to do, and they can be helpful. And if they don't happen to provide, like, you know, if it's a little bit more equity that you give them rather than, you know, another investor who can't help at all, then, you know, that's a sacrifice that can be worth making, right? Don't hold so tightly to your view on what that equity should be. Because, you know, equity is a great tool to align interests, not just in relation to investors, but in relation to co-founders as well. Yeah, I see that quite a lot in terms of, you know, disagreements between co-founders, disagreements between potential investors, around that early equity, right? You don't want to give away so much that, you know, there's no longer a vested interest in the business, but you don't want to optimize it so such that, you know, that those interests are no longer aligned. Yeah, and it's a constant sort of education that I'm providing around it. Yeah.
Thanks for providing it to us.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you're going through and looking for folks who can invest in your business, really think about, you know, can I work with this person for the next 6 years? You're interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you.
Do you have any advice for early stage founders on doing diligence on investors?
Yes. The best diligence is to speak to the folks that they've invested in. The even better diligence is to see if you can find folks that they didn't invest in and to see what the experience was, right? In fact, you should try to do both, yeah? So for us, for example, as we go through our process looking to invest in, startups, what we do is we provide to them a list. You know, here is basically all of our founders. Let us know who you would like to talk to and we'll make the connection. You can talk to them. Ask them whatever you like, right? And what's great to ask is, you know, how did the investor react when things didn't go as planned, when things didn't go well? Yeah, what specific help did they provide to you after the investment specifically? In what ways did they help? You know, ask them about their process. How long did it take? What did they need? What did they look at? What did they ask for? So all of these things are helpful. But yeah, you want to speak to the folks that they've invested in and some folks that they didn't invest in but spoke to as well. Yeah.
And what do people never ask you that you wish they did?
What do people never ask me? In relation to the round or the startup?
Generally.
I wish that more of the people that I come across and work with asked more of a view of, you know, how, right, rather than what, right? The way of doing things, the process of doing things, for me is always much more interesting than necessarily the outcome, right? And so I wish that people would ask more around how was this done. How did you think about going through this? And it all boils, but for me, it boils back to an element of self-awareness that they're looking to build over time. Because I think that true leadership for founders comes from building their self-awareness such that they can continue to build their leadership capabilities and grow over time. Because, you know, initially you're starting off with a team of 2-3 people. That ends up becoming a team of 50 people, And for some of our businesses, they're, you know, the teams are like 300 people, but it's the same founders. And so throughout that entire period, they've had to grow and learn. And they're constantly asking, you know, the best founders I find are always asking, you know, how? You know, how do I evolve? How do I grow? Rather than just looking at the outcome.
And so, other than that, what are some of the other common attributes you observe to sort of like highly successful founders? I know there's a lot of survivorship bias, but
yeah,
more so generally.
I find that our best founders are really good at figuring new things out. Just, you know, how do things really work? What's the reality of how do things really work right now in this particular space? So for example, we have some founders that are not experienced with raising capital at all, right? They're just great at building product. However, when it comes time for them to learn about raising capital, they're like all in. They're reading everything, asking everybody, asking, you know, every question, and they're just figuring it out. And then not only are they figuring it out, they're figuring out how to like really optimize the process. So our best founders seem to, whether it's around capital raising or, you know, geographic expansion or trying to hire 10 new engineers in a completely new space, right? They're just saying, okay, right, let me figure out how things are working right now. Let me see where, you know, we can optimize around this, and let me see how do we get to the optimal outcome here. So they're really awesome learners.
It strikes me that you've identified the best founders are people who are learning something maybe at the very last minute before they need that knowledge.
Yeah.
And to me, this comes down to a question of focus. For
yes.
Founders, they're always debating what they should focus their energy on at any given point in time.
Mm.
So do you have any general advice around focus for founders and how they should decide where to put their energy at any given point?
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy, is the first point, but you focus on the aspects that give you the most impact, yeah? And, you know, you can almost sort of say, you know, what's the thing that I can do now that will have the biggest impact on the most customers, right? So, for example, you know, you could be working on, from a product perspective, you could be working on some, you know, function point that's nested within another, you know, another branch of the menu, you know, three levels down, or you could be reducing friction in the sign-up process that would affect everybody, right? And so, you know, the question is always not necessarily what do I focus on, it's what don't I focus on? What's going to be cut, right? What don't I do? But again, you know, whether it's from a product perspective or other aspects of the business, what's going to have the biggest impact? And typically within the life cycle stage of the startup, and especially early on, what's going to have the biggest impact in a relatively short period of time, right? Because you can't be bulletproofing or goal-proofing or, you know, your solution for, you know, 3 years' time. You might not be around then. You'll be able to figure it out by then. Whatever you need to throw out, you'll be able to throw out as long as you're mindful of what that is, yeah? But the hardest part I found is not what do we focus on, it's what do we drop? Where do we put that line, right? And usually, you know, for our teams, we help them to work backwards. So for example, what do you need to look like to raise your next round of funding, which will give you your oxygen for the following round? Right, and so if we work backwards from there, we can see, oh, you'll need to achieve this from a team perspective, a product perspective, and a revenue perspective, a cost perspective. Okay, well, if we need to achieve these things for the next round, then how do we work backwards to decide what we need to do right now? And everything that doesn't work towards that, basically, that's where the line is.
And coming to that, when you look at especially very early stage where people are still figuring out their product and
yeah.
so on.
Yeah.
How would you advise, so say for example, for coaches or mentors to approach something like this where, okay, this is if you want to raise, say, seed or angel capital.
Yeah.
And the stuff that you need to do to be able to get there.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more chaos in that early days versus
Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a lot harder earlier on. I guess with that early stage, you're looking for a very specific type of investor as well, right? An investor that, for example, understands that you'll be experimenting a lot of the time, and hopefully they'll want to understand the experiments that you've run, what's worked, what hasn't worked. Hopefully there'll be folks who can focus on what are the key strengths here of this particular team and of this particular business right now, rather than looking just sort of coldly at, you know, traction and those sorts of things. At Series A, it's a little bit different, and at Series B, it's quite fundamentally different again. But seed stage is really, and I know that a lot of people say this, seed stage is a lot about, you know, the founder group, yeah? How does this team make decisions? How do they work together? It's a lot about the market space that they're in. Is this a compelling market space to participate in? What does the market space actually look like? And then at the traction in the product, because you know it's going to change so much, even over the next 12 months. So you're just trying to look for signs, directionality, right? But the better seed investors will be able to understand that. Yeah.
If you were to look at the ideal founding team,
yeah,
sort of leading into the seed stage,
yeah,
what do they look like?
For me, I mean, outside of our fund, I also make angel investments. And the angel investments that I make always have at least one engineer in the founding team, at least one engineer, ideally more. And for me, that's really important. It's not mandatory. For some seed stage investors, it's okay. But for me, it's really important to have an engineer as part of the founding team, because it makes such a big difference to a couple of things. One, the pace of iteration is fundamentally impacted by having or not having an engineer or a couple of engineers in the founding team. Absolutely fundamentally. There is, from a cost perspective, an impact as well, and so that will impact on dilution. So if you want to have founders in a founding group that have more of their own equity as the business progresses, usually they're not raising as much early on, and they're not spending that money on a lot of external engineers because they've got them internally. Yeah, so it's not a fundamental requirement, but I mean, if I'm making an angel investment, I don't think I've made one in a business that didn't have an engineer as part of the founding team. And then aside from that, of course, you know, ideally, I want to see somebody who has a really strong vision for the business, and has, you know, some of those sort of hustler hacker type, you know, skill sets. It's very rare to find all of that in one person, so I've never invested from an angel perspective in a sole founder. I believe in teams of at least, you know, two, ideally three, early on. You know, whether that's sort of the classic, you know, hustler, hacker, hipster sort of, you know, triumvirate, or whether it's two folks who have some type of combination of those skills. Having an engineer, I think, is really, really, for me anyway, really important.
It's just an engineer, as in like software engineer?
Like a dev. Yeah.
So this is purely for software based, not different types of startups?
Yeah, I mean, I only invest in tech startups, so, you know, that's kind of the lens that I'm applying.
Yeah.
In other types of, I guess you could say, you know, what are the sort of key building blocks of the business, and can those core building blocks be at least started by the skill sets that exist within the team? And what's really important for me is actually the pace of iteration, right, and the cost of iteration. So if you can, early on, have a quite, you know, high frequency of iteration and build, and a reduce costs early on along the way, that's really the core principle here. Of course, I'm applying a tech sort of startup lens, but it could be quite specific to the type of business that you're looking to build.
And you never mentioned the idea. How important do you think the idea is for early stage startups?
I'm not that fussed about the idea. I'm more focused on, is this team going to be one that's able to execute? And where are they at from an execution perspective? What have they been able to prove out? There are a lot of great ideas out there. I'm interested in, how does this team think about this problem space? What are the insights that they have that are unique to this particular team in relation to this problem space? Do I think that this team could be one of the best in the world at solving this particular problem? Right. This is how I'm thinking about, you know, sort of seed stage teams, rather than the actual idea in and of itself. Yeah.
And sort of moving on to a very different lens. If you had to start your own startup today, what would you focus on and why?
I guess, you know, for me, if I was to start something now, it'll be in or around the investment space in some way, some type of tool to help me sort of solve the problems that I've experienced as an investor, whether it's from a diligence perspective or from a sourcing perspective or from a, you know, helping businesses after the investment perspective and tracking them and all this sort of stuff. And it's around, you know, what sort of insights have I derived from the work that I've been doing in this space over the last, you know, few years? Can I help to sort of solve some of those problems with the work that I intend to do? That's probably what I would do. I guess another part of my work that we haven't talked about is I've been teaching meditation to small groups since 2007, roughly. And then over the course of that time, I've been sort of working with students ad hoc around mindfulness and meditation. And then earlier this year, I decided to do it by cohort. So I worked with 4 students, intensely one-to-one, and the first cohort has finished, and I'm going to ask them to sort of share their learnings on Medium in a couple of weeks' time, and I've just started with the second cohort. And so it might be, you know, if I do a startup, it might be alternatively something in that mindfulness space. Yeah, right. So it's always something that, you know, I want to have a direct connection, a very direct connection to the problem space. And, you know, leveraging any sort of insights that I have with the experience that I have within that problem space.
And how did you get involved in mindfulness and meditation? And what is that sort of, does that help you in your work or life?
Yeah, it's been very, very helpful. It's been very, very helpful with my work. So I found that as I have progressed with my mindfulness work, it's been really helpful in forming a view of and understanding how founders sort of look at the world from their perspective, how they see themselves, how I can help those founders to, for example, reduce the stress that they inevitably feel, all the pressure and stress. So yeah, it's been extremely helpful both for myself and for the folks that I work with. It's probably one sort of key inflection point in, I guess, my career. You know, moving more and more towards the work that I want to do, and you know, sort of letting go of the work that I, you know, that I was less interested in. But there are a couple of key sort of inflection points in my career, and that's certainly taking up meditation is certainly one very, very key aspect.
I noticed Ray Dalio, one of the world's biggest hedge fund investors, is a big advocate of TM, Transcendental Meditation.
Yeah.
And I've noticed this is a common thread among many successful people. For early stage founders, aside from reducing stress, how do you think meditation can change their life?
Well, it certainly changed mine quite fundamentally. The way that it has is that I understand what's going on underneath a whole lot better. So, you know, you've got this sort of, imagine like, you know, there's a radio and you're kind of operating at one, you're tuned into one particular frequency, but underneath there are like all these other frequencies that are running, such as, you know, I'm sure you guys have heard it before. There's this inner critic that says, hey, we really should be doing this and you're not good enough at that and we really should be having this and not that, and da 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 da, making judgments all the time. I'm sure underneath that there is, you know, some type of inner child that is wanting to play more and be more creative and experience more and all those sorts of things. And the work that I've been doing is really sort of unpacking what's going on underneath. And as I understand myself better, I find that I'm understanding other people better as well. And I can empathize with, you know, how they're thinking about the world and where they're at. It's changed me absolutely fundamentally. And in the beginning, the work was very internal, you know, looking inside a lot. How do I look at the world? Being mindful of my particular lens on the world and unpacking that. And then as I progressed with the work, it was more sort of looking up like a kind of like a meerkat, right? And looking around and saying, hey, actually, I understand myself so much better now. How do I now from this place contribute to others and contribute to community? And that's where the sort of work is evolving to at this point in time.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thanks for sharing. And for someone who hasn't done meditation before, what first steps could they take?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of really cool free podcasts. And I'm very happy to share a list with the cohort. Some great free sort of guided meditations just to sit and listen to, which hopefully will help. That's kind of how I started. And then I worked with specific teachers for, you know, various years. That's a really good place to start. And, really what you're doing in the beginning anyway is just getting used to just dropping everything else, at least for a short period of time, and just allowing yourself just to breathe. Right? Imagine like all these thoughts in your mind, like this cup of coffee, you're holding it, you know, if you're holding it for an hour, it starts to get a bit wearing, but imagine that you're holding it for like weeks and weeks and months on end. It starts to get really heavy. And so for beginners anyway, the idea first up is just to, hey, I'm just going to put this cup of coffee down for a moment. And in this moment, right at that point, I'm just going to breathe. I'm going to drop everything else. Give myself permission to drop everything else. And I'm just going to be. Those worries and concerns about the past and the future, they will still be there in 5 minutes' time. But I feel so much better just to be able to drop it for now. And I feel refreshed to be able to pick it up again later on. Okay, so as a beginner, that's all I'm trying to get folks to do. Of course, as the work continues and as people get more advanced, they start to contemplate more and unpack what are these thoughts that, you know, I've been sort of spending my time sort of running around and thinking about, right? Why am I sort of rejecting this from the past and grasping for this from the future and all those sorts of things? But in the beginning, you know, it's just refreshing just to be able to just let everything go and just to breathe and just to, you know, be yourself with no other encumbrances. That's it.
And just one last follow-up question to this. Do you offer these sessions only to your portfolio companies? Or
is... No, I run them from time to time. I've run sessions for various, accelerators and agencies and small teams and, you know, all those sorts of things. And now I'm really focused on one-to-one. And the one-to-one folks that I work with, they're not, you know, I mean, yes, there are a couple of founders in the group, but they're not necessarily, none of them are like portfolio companies. Yeah, it's just sort of, are you ready for that more advanced work? But, you know, I'm very happy to send some resources through to folks who are interested in finding out more. And, you know, if there's time, I'm not sure if there will be time before the end of the cohort. So it might be something that can be run in the next cohort. Happy to do a session for folks that are interested, right?
Amazing.
And maybe folks from previous cohorts can come and, if they're interested as well. I'd be very happy to do that.
Maybe right in the lead up to everyone's pitch at the showcase.
Maybe. We'll see what we can do from a timing perspective. But if it's not this time, we'll do it next time. And I definitely want to, help and run a session. So,
yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, and just sort of very classic sort of 101 mindfulness meditation stuff.
That'd be very helpful.
And sort of following up from that, how important do you think sort of mental health and well-being for startup founders? Because there's so much stress involved.
Yeah, there is so much stress involved. Yeah, there is. I think that there is an event in Sydney coming up soon specifically to talk about that, and it's a very important issue. I've seen really, you know, tough situations. For example, I've seen situations where folks have raised money from family and friends, for example, which adds another layer of stress, right? So you've got the stress of running the business, running out of runway. Then you've got the stress on top of that of having raised from, you know, close friends and family and not being able to, you know, and if the business fails, it makes it even more difficult, right? So, yeah, I've seen these sort of situations, or even, you know, stress between founders and, you know, folks having to drop out because it's just too much for them to handle. So, yes, it's a very important issue. I think it's an issue that I would love for founders and founding teams to check in with each other around, which is, hey, you know, just genuinely, how are you feeling right now? Right? And doing that regularly. In fact, for some of the folks that I work with, I get them to ask themselves that question a couple of times a day, which is just physically and mentally, just how am I feeling right now? Because if you ask yourself that question and you get, oh, actually, I'm feeling a little bit anxious right now, or I'm feeling a bit angry right now, or whatever it is, right? It's no judgment around the feeling, just what is it? You might decide, for example, you know what? I'm not going to write this email right now because I know that I'm feeling angry or sad, or maybe I'll park that until, you know, another time. But being aware of how you feel, you know, having that sort of feedback loop with yourself, I think is really important. And then as a founding team, asking that question, you know, hey, this, you know, we're in the trenches right now. You know, I just want to check in on how we're all feeling about this, right? And just asking that question, I think is helpful, right? It just gets that dialogue going. Yeah, so yes, it's a very, very important issue. It's quite prevalent within the startup ecosystem. I'm sure you all can see why, right? And so, yeah, I'm glad that it's sort of, you know, becoming more visible now.
It's definitely more visible, but I think it's still part of the culture that founders are expected to be brave and strong. The people who don't feel emotion or anger or suffering, you know.
Yeah.
So for the leaders, the founders, how would you suggest they go about creating a culture in their team where it is okay to have those conversations?
First of all, I actually think that it's brave and strong to be transparent about it. I think that's the braver thing to do. And I think it starts with you. if you express how you're feeling and put it out there first and take that chance to put it out there first, usually other folks will follow. You know, if you're willing to show a little bit of vulnerability, a little bit of doubt, of course, a lot of honesty, you'll find that most often it gets reciprocated, right? And if it doesn't, you're sort of still moving folks along in the journey. Maybe they're just not ready yet on their end. But if you don't, you're not really moving anybody else along. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it starts with you to role model the behavior that you would like to see. And it can be hard, right? It's not easy to be vulnerable in front of the rest of your team, right? But you have to kind of take that chance. And hopefully over time that will be reciprocated as well. Usually it is. From what I've seen, usually it does get reciprocated.
I want to ask I want to find the balance. I'm not sure in terms of when you have another job and then you have your own, like your stuff that you're starting up.
Yeah.
You know, I guess sometimes when people start up, they're up all night, you know, doing the other stuff.
Yeah.
Or, you know, some people have to, you know, maybe go part-time than full-time.
Yeah.
You know, but they need to still make bread. They need to still, you know, make some kind of money.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a lot of zeal, you've got a lot of passion, but, you know, sometimes that can, you know, become a little issue. I mean, especially when you've been driving for so long? And how do you split, you know, the time to focus on this? You know, because some people don't have a luxury of saying, okay, well, they can just be a founder. That's all they can do. If they have the support, at, like, money-wise, they, that's all they can do. But if they don't and they still need to, you know, pay rent, pay this, pay that.
Yeah.
You know, is it something that you have to do early in the morning? Is it something you have to do? I know no one can give you this 100% answer.
Yeah.
But I guess, yeah, I'm an opinion, you know.
It's a really good question. It's a really good question, and it's a really tough question. The principle that I have around this is that your time is worth more than any investor's money, right? And anybody's money, in fact. So there is no straight answer as to how you're going to be able to balance having to bring in an income versus finding out. But the goal should be, how can I find out, what would I need to do to convince myself that this is worth all of my time? Right? What does that look like? Right? Whether it's from a numbers perspective, or is this the business that I want to build? Do I have enough passion for it? All these sort of things, right? What does that look like? And, you know, to do whatever you can to find that out as quickly as possible, so that, you know, you're not committing your time into something that, you know, you may not move forward with. And when you can get to that point, you'll know, because that's the point when likely, if you can convince yourself, that's the point when likely an investor will be able to be convinced as well, right? And most investors will typically invest in a company when the founder says, okay, I'm in this full time, right? I don't know, I mean, of any angel investors that sort of invest in businesses where the founder is part-time, yeah? So the first check-in point is actually with yourself. Once you've been able to convince yourself, you're probably likely to be able to convince an angel investor. But I would say there is no easy answer to this. And it's a really hard part of the process, which is, when do I jump, right? But the principle is, see what it takes to convince yourself first as to whether or not you would jump. And what does that look like? And then figure out, what will it take to get to that point from here? And what you want to do is try to optimize for time. Optimize for time. So if you find that, hey, I can only do this on weekends, then so be it. But you know that it's going to take more time. If you find that I can do this outside of, you know, work hours, then so be it. You'll probably compress some of that time. But whatever you can do to compress that time, try to do, because you want to find out as quickly as possible whether this is something you want to move on from or not. Okay? But yeah, you know, you have to live, right? You have to live and you have to earn a living. And you know what? Even after you raise capital, you're still only paying yourself what they call ramen money, which is just enough to, like, sort of get by on, right? And everything else goes into the business anyway. So it's a different type of problem later on, but there are some similarities, right? But yeah, as I said, the principle is, try to figure out, what is that point at which I would be happy to come on board full time? What does this business have to look like at that point to convince me? And your bar actually should be higher than any investor, because your time is the most precious, right? And how do I find out? How do I get to that point as quickly as I can?
And then what is your thinking around moving away from an idea? Because a lot of times we have this sunk cost and all the time that we've put into something.
Yeah.
And then realizing that it might not work. How do you look at it? And have you seen any examples of people that have done that successfully and moved on to something better?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very hard thing to do, because you're so, you know, vested in this idea. The folks that I've seen it do well around this are the folks who set their metrics from the beginning. They say, oh, if we hit X, Y, and Z, whether it's in terms of customers or engagement or revenue or whatever it is, if we hit X, Y, and Z by this time, you know, I push forward. Or if I can hit this milestone by this time, I'm going to push forward. But if I don't hit this milestone, basically, I'm going to drop it. okay? And there might be some mitigations along the way, so you give yourself a little bit more time, but they always have this is the drop dead time frame. And so folks who set that up front tend to stick to it more often than folks who try to work it out along the way, right? And so you might set it up front and you might still move it, right, in process because you're finding out things that you didn't know before. That's fine. But the folks who I find who sort of can be quite effective at dropping something that's not working are the folks who set that milestone up front at the very beginning.
Any questions for you guys?
Going back to when you said you raised your funding in 3 months.
Yeah.
And you said usually people takes 1 year.
Yeah.
How did you do it differently?
I think we were fortunate in that the timing was great timing. Raising in the first half of 2015 was, you know, coincidentally great timing to raise capital across Southeast Asia. For example, if we were to start today raising a first time fund, I think it would take us a lot longer. What did we do? We treated it like a sales funnel. So we basically said, okay, what do we want to do? What sort of fund do we want to create? Now, who would we want to have as our ideal investors in that fund? And so we actually had a list. You know, here are the sort of most ideal investors in one category. Here's the second category of, you know, second type of ideal investors, not as ideal as the first, but still ideal. And then we just treated it as a sales funnel with different types of targets. And we optimized our offering and our fundraising and our documents and the way that we express things to those targets. So for example, our investors in Fund 1 are all large corporates. Three large corporates from Japan and three large corporates from Southeast Asia. We come from, for example, I came from a corporate venture capital background. And so, you know, the way that we articulated the fund was, what would a corporate investor in a fund want to see? Now, bear in mind, these companies are multi-billion dollar companies. There's nothing that we can really do from a return on investment perspective that will even halfway move the needle for them, right? Even if we delivered like 10x our fund, okay? Because these are huge, huge companies. So what do they want? Well, we figured that they would want to learn. They would want transparency. They would want our perspective on things. So we focused on that as a part of the raising process. So we focus on, okay, if you invest in our fund, we're going to be able to, for example, you can dial into all of our investment committee meetings, right? You can read all of our investment committee papers. You know, when we see something interesting for you in the startup ecosystem, we're going to make that connection and introduce you to those teams. By the way, if you're looking to acquire some startups, you know, if you let us know what those areas are and those types of startups are, we can, as we come across them, we can pass them through to you and bring them on your radar, right? None of this has to do with financial return, right? But it's got to do with helping that, you know, investor to achieve their goals, whether it's to learn, whether it's to understand what's going on in the market, whether it's to understand how we make investments so that they can help their teams, to understand how they can make investments internally from that point onwards in tech. So yeah, that's how we did it. We kind of optimized to, we try to put ourselves into the shoes of the other party, see what it is that they could be interested in, and optimize what we do for, you know, to help sort of solve what they might be looking for.
How do you manage the relationship with your investors? And in particular, how do you manage the tensions perhaps between their objectives and your own objectives?
Yeah. the way that we work and the way that most funds work is that, it's the partners who are making the investment decisions. So our investors, they don't get a say in what we invest in. In fact, they've invested in us because they trust in our decision-making process. And so, you know, they don't get a say. And so there's no sort of having to sort of balance you know, their sort of investment requirements versus ours, it's always ours, right? But the balancing point for us is, when do we make these introductions for either companies that we've met with or our own portfolio companies to get some, you know, engagement with our investors? And sometimes it's early on, sometimes we wait a bit later, sometimes we have to be mindful of any potential conflicts, for example, right? So that's the balancing that we do on our side, yeah. But from an investment perspective, it's not. I mean, we luckily have the freedom to make the investment decisions that we as a partnership want to make.
Well, sort of a leading question. What I was thinking about was, especially early stage founders when they meet angels and advisors and potential investors.
Yeah.
I think it's common for them to get advice or to get tugged in a certain direction, which usually pulls them into alignment with that person's objectives.
Yeah.
So do you have any advice around how founders should manage that tension?
Yeah. And it doesn't just happen from an investment perspective. It can happen from a customer perspective as well. We see it all the time, you know. Your first few customers might ask you to do things that are very specific to them. And if they're your only customers, then you're, of course, drawn to... what they're asking you to do. At the end of the day, you have to have a vision for your business and how you would like to run it. Everything else comes in as thoughts, ideas, feedback that you have to synthesize to see if it works for you. And by the way, nobody knows your business better than you do, right? Your job is to filter and synthesize and decide what will apply. I mean, even for angel investors who have done really well in the startup space, the things that they've learnt may no longer apply, right? There is always some element of survivorship bias. There's always some element of, hey, you know, the platforms that we were using in, you know, 2005 or 2010, they may not be the platforms that might give you traction anymore today. So you need to sort of, you need to balance one level of coachability, right? And two, with your own understanding, deep, deep, deep understanding of your own business, right? Because the investor might have spent a few hours thinking about your business, even a few days, right, is a lot. You've been thinking about your business for the last, you know, few years, right? And working in that business. So nobody will be able to give you a view on your business better than yourself, okay? But it's your job to synthesize. Now, when it comes to learning about new aspects and areas, you can have much more of an open mind, right? How do I raise capital? How do I scale into a different country? How do I hire this type of person that I've never hired before? That's great for sort of getting input from, you know, your investors or other people. But if you don't have a vision as your anchor point, it's really easy to be led by, you know, whoever it is that may be sort of there to influence you. Because, hey, you know, like an investor is going to provide you money to do your life's work. So, yes, they're in a position to be highly highly influencing in terms of your direction. Yeah, you need to choose them very wisely.
Great. Well, does anyone else have any questions?
Good.
We'll wrap it up.
Cool.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Peter.
You're
really
very welcome.
Appreciate it.
Fascinating conversation. Thank
yeah,
you so much
cool.
for your time.
Not at all. You're very welcome.
Gone all the way from fundraising to your life to managing.